Hey everybody, it's Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina today. This is The Takeaway for June 13th. Today, the impact of policing in the LGBTQ community, 50 years after Stonewall.
Stonewall was one of many riots that took place and one of many events over decades that helped destroy the trust in law enforcement. And it's going to take many, many, many more years to regain that trust and to overcome all of that history.
Also on the show, Hong Kong is a big business hub, but a proposed change to extradition laws and massive protests have the territory on edge.
In a way, it has everything to lose, but it has very little control over its fate.
And Warriors star Kevin Durant's torn Achilles highlights the pressure pro athletes feel from their team and themselves to come back from injuries. Let's get started, people. We're about midway through June, the month known as Pride. That is, of course, because of an event that took place 50 years ago, just up the street from our studios here at WNYC. On June 28th, 1969, the New York City Police Department raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in downtown Manhattan. Officers physically and verbally harassed the patrons of the bar and performed invasive checks on some of the gender nonconforming patrons. The patrons fought back, and the clashes lasted for 6 days. Last week, a half century later, New York City Police Commissioner James O'Neill took the step of formally apologizing for the NYPD's actions at Stonewall.
The actions taken by the NYPD were wrong, plain and simple. The actions and the laws were discriminatory and oppressive, and for that, I apologize.
I don't expect that an apology is going to heal all of the wounds or will suddenly reverse all of the mistrust that members of the community have towards law enforcement, but it's a step in the right direction. It's a piece of the puzzle.
And that is?
Greg Moralia. I'm a career veteran member of law enforcement and have been teaching in law enforcement at the Law Enforcement Academy in Napa for 33 years.
Things are different now than they were 3 decades ago.
When I walked in the door at age 15 in 1978 to the first police department I worked for, I heard the words, "Don't be gay, queer," in a very derogatory way immediately. So the culture and the environment there signaled to me right away that there was no way that I could be out.
But in 2004, Greg did come out, and he says the experience was pretty positive. Today, he helps lead LGBTQ anti-bias training for several departments around the country. And he says that while the NYPD's apology for Stonewall is not going to suddenly make things right between the LGBTQ community and the police, it is a step in the right direction.
And I think it goes in hand with the effort that police departments are making in terms of showcasing their LGBT members by participating in pride celebrations, having booths, recruiting booths at LGBT pride celebrations. It's all a part of the effort that needs to take place to build that trust.
Building trust. Police departments all across the country are trying to do that work, but many are still falling short. In a 2014 survey of queer people and people living with HIV conducted by the LGBT rights group Lambda Legal, over 70% of respondents said they had interacted directly with police officers in the past 5 years. More than a fifth of those respondents described those interactions as hostile. People of color and transgender people reported even higher levels of negative interactions in the survey. So let's talk about it. I have two guests with me now who've been studying the relationship between LGBTQ people and the police. Matteo Della Torre is a racial and economic justice policy advocate for the National Center for Transgender Equality. Thanks for being here, Matteo.
Thank you for having me.
And Andrea Ritchie is a police misconduct attorney and co-author of Queer Injustice, the criminalization of LGBT people in the United States. Andrea, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with you, Andrea. Coming as it did 50 years after the events at Stonewall, how meaningful is an apology from the police commissioner here in New York?
I'm sorry to say not particularly meaningful, given that not much has changed 50 years later. While the laws and policies might have changed, LGBT people's experiences of policing and police abuse and criminalization are largely the same, especially for the LGBT communities who led the Stonewall Uprising, homeless LGBT people, trans LGBT people of color. And that's true even in the very area where the Stonewall Inn is located. The Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York City put out a study in 2016 finding the highest rates of complaints of discrimination and abuse by police officers based on sexual orientation and gender identity took place in that very neighborhood. And in my experience of litigating police misconduct and working with police departments across the country and organizers across the country, many of the very same patterns of abuse that drove that raid and that uprising continue to this day unabated, whether under the same laws or under different laws. And so things might be different for white gay men like Greg, who are police officers, but they're not different for the very communities that led the Stonewall Uprising and who were targeted and continue to be targeted by police officers.
So, Andrea, what are some of the most common forms of harassment that LGBTQ people report in their dealings with the police?
Things range everything from verbal harassment and name calling, which was the sort of number one complaint that the Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York City received, to being misgendered as a trans person. The gender searches that you described at the Stonewall Inn continue to this day. In fact, I filed a lawsuit in 2005 arguing that the NYPD has a pattern and practice of engaging in those gender searches. It led to sweeping policy changes, which at the time were some of the most progressive in the country. But what experience has revealed is that those policy changes are only as good as the paper they're written on if the department is not committed to enforcing them, to training officers on them, and holding them accountable for violating them. And I have since represented a number of trans and gender nonconforming people who have experienced the exact same gender searches, sexual assaults, physical assault, criminalization, profiling, and targeting by law enforcement officers that sort of drove those policy changes in the first place. And the New York City Office of Inspector General recently confirmed that the department hadn't trained most of its officers on it and certainly wasn't making sure that they knew the policies and practices that had been negotiated by the LGBT community and were enforcing them. So the reality is that, you know, while police officers, maybe at Pride, which is something that many members of the LGBT community very much object to, given the long history and continuing history of abuse and violence, essentially we've put a rainbow flag on the exact same kinds of police policies and practices, from verbal abuse, name calling, gender searches, strip searches. LGBT people experience some of the highest rates of physical violence by law enforcement officers, highest rates of sexual violence and extortion by law enforcement officers, and profiling and criminalization. And that's reflected in the population, in the incarcerated population as well. The same study you referred to by Lambda Legal shows that LGBT people experience 5 times the rate of incarceration of the general population. Other studies have shown that 42% of people incarcerated in women's prison identified as lesbian, bisexual, or gender nonconforming before they were incarcerated. That's not our representation in the general population. I may wish it was, but it's not. And while we all know that 1 in 3 Black men experience incarceration in their lifetime, many of us don't know that 1 in 2 Black trans women will experience incarceration in their lifetime. And those statistics are the product of the very same policing practices that drove the uprising at Stonewall and in so many other places around the country over the years. And the last thing I would say is that the kinds of rating of establishments, of queer establishments, of LGBT establishments, may be something also that we think has stopped. And in fact, that continues. On the 40th anniversary of Stonewall Uprising, there was a raid on the Rainbow Lounge in Dallas, which was very similar to the Stonewall experience. There was a raid in the Eagle Bar in Atlanta the same year, 40 years after Stonewall. I represented 2 women who were beaten by police during a raid of a gay bar in Brooklyn in 2009 and called slurs while they were being beaten by the police. So literally the same things that happened at Stonewall continue to happen to this day.
Now, Mateo, I'd like to bring you into this, too. You published a report earlier this year that looked at the transgender policies of 25 different police departments across the country. What were some of the departments you looked at, and how many of them had clear transgender policies to begin with?
Yeah, thank you. So we looked at the largest 25 police departments, and that included the NYPD, the LAPD, Chicago PD, San Diego PD, and a handful of other departments. And what we found was not surprising. We actually used a model policy that was primarily developed by Andrea Ritchie to see how these departments' policies were measuring up against what we considered would be best practices, right? And what we found is that, first of all, most of these departments ended up not having most or any of these policies in place case at all. But one of the most stark findings for me, at least, was that the departments that did have policies on how to respectfully use somebody's name and pronouns, how to respectfully ask for that, how to not perform invasive searches on transgender people to determine their genitalia or quote-unquote their real sex or their real identity, we found that none of these departments required any form of training on the policies that they did have. So even if a department had everything perfect in policy, they weren't necessarily preparing their officers. And we did a quick estimate, and it seems like there's 117,000 officers under these 25 largest police departments across the country, and the NYPD has around 38,000 of those. So these departments are just simply not preparing their officers to go off and engage with every single member of their community. And based on all the statistics and experiences that we know that Andrea mentioned, and based on what we know from the U.S. Transgender Survey, that 58% of transgender respondents were mistreated, and that does include part of what Andrea was talking about verbal harassment. But it goes as far to talk about folks experiencing being forced to engage in sexual activity to avoid arrest. So we know that these departments are just simply not preparing their officers to go off and engage respectfully with the transgender community.
And given the high levels of mistrust, according to your own organization, 57% of respondents were uncomfortable calling the police for help. What are the consequences of that mistrust?
Yeah, so we know that transgender people are just extremely vulnerable to being victimized just on their daily lives. And that includes by the police. I mean, there's, I think, one in three Black transgender women has an officer assume that they're a sex worker just because of being who they are and walking down the street. And it becomes increasingly difficult. There's currently a bill in California, SB 233, that will create a safe space for, in theory, create a safe space for sex workers to be able to come in and report violent crime against them or come forward as witnesses of a number of violent crimes without fearing being arrested for engaging in the sex trade. For example, transgender people, a lot of transgender people end up in survival work, and that includes the drug trade, and that includes sex work. And a lot of the times, it's not as a main form of employment, right? It's not out of their choice. It's because these are the few avenues that are available to them due to a whole factor of discrimination. And when you don't necessarily feel comfortable going to the police for help, who do you go to when the police are the people that are terrorizing you, the people that are victimizing you? And especially when you go in and looking at this report, there's just a severe lack of civilian oversight across the country when the department itself is responsible for holding its officers accountable. It makes it less likely that anybody would be, specifically transgender people and transgender people of color, will be able to find justice.
Mateo, what are some policy changes you want to see more police departments adopt?
Yeah, I want departments to stop policing the sex trade. Some of our most vulnerable people in the transgender community are sex workers, and they are just being continually victimized and by law enforcement and not being able to find the few avenues of income that provide food for their table, that keep a roof over their head, and allow for them to continue existing and moving forward with their transitions. So that's one big thing that I want them to do. And specifically in New York, you know, we know that the Decrim New York just introduced a sex work decriminalization bill, and there should be a lot of attention being paid to that, and there should be overwhelming support from every single member of the community for that. Another thing is I want folks to start respecting the identities of transgender people. I have heard countless stories from transgender people where their ID doesn't necessarily match their gender identity, either in their name or their gender marker. And that is an opportunity where officers usually take the opportunity to let everybody know in the near area that this person is a transgender person. That means that they don't really understand the dangers that they're putting this one individual in. I asked one police officer, what are you doing to protect sex workers? And their response was, yeah, sex work is a real problem. You know, they're down on that street. And it seemed like the culture of this conversation and around transgender people in general and sex workers was that they were not the type of person that deserved to be protected by that department. And that just says a lot about the culture in these departments. People think that they've never met a transgender person, and that is a lie. Transgender people exist in every area of life, whether we are out and visible or whether we're not. We are in those communities. We have transgender police officers. And the fact that the law enforcement community hasn't been more proactive in educating themselves on the needs and services that need to be provided for transgender people, it's just significantly overdue.
So you mentioned transgender police officers. I'm curious about how you view police participation in Pride events, say, that's often met with a certain amount of resistance. This is what Greg Moralia had to say about that.
If you believe that one of the ideas around Pride and Pride celebrations is promoting inclusion, acceptance, and equality, then excluding any members of the community from participating and being part of that message makes you a hypocrite. I also don't believe that excluding LGBT members of law enforcement from participating in a pride parade in uniform is going to have any fix at all of the current concerns that people have about things like police use of force.
Andrea, how do you view the participation of law enforcement in pride parades?
I believe uniform law enforcement has no place in a pride parade for exactly the reasons that we've been talking about, is that their relationship, they make people literally feel unsafe at pride. And for many years, I was legal support for people of color organizations participating in pride in New York City. And the amount of violence by law enforcement during pride towards LGBT people of color made their participation make many people feel unsafe. It didn't, literally, there was a disconnect between, you know, the rainbow banner float at the front and the cops beating people at the back. And there's no place. I think that the concerns that Greg is raising are better addressed by actually changing the behavior of the police department in the ways that Teo is talking about than sort of, as I said, slapping a rainbow flag on it once a year and coming to Pride and making most people who are participating in Pride feel actually more unsafe, not more safe.
Has there been visible change in the number, the representation of LGBT members of police forces in New York or elsewhere?
I think there has been, certainly in terms of the number of out police officers, but I think as we've seen with other communities, that doesn't change the behavior. I think we've seen an increase in the number of police officers of color, and we still see rampant police violence against Black and brown communities. We've seen increased numbers of police officers who are immigrants and rampant police violence against migrant communities and so forth. So I think, again, it's not about representation. It's about changed behavior. And I think that as long as police departments are trying to look good on paper and maybe sort of pinkwashing their department while continuing to engage in the same behavior, then I don't think we're actually moving forward. And that's the key. And I think that ultimately, in response to the question that you posed to Mateo, I think that there has to be concrete changes in behavior. And if there can't be, which has been our experience over the past 50 years, whether police are responding to LGBT people on the street or responding to them when they're calling for help, which in Atlanta, a study by the Solutions Not Punishment Coalition found that in 38% of cases where trans women called for help from the police, they were arrested instead. There are cases like Kai Peterson's in Georgia, where he was a Black trans man who was sexually assaulted, defended himself, and was convicted of a crime for defending himself because the police officers literally say, "You don't look like a rape victim to us." So when that kind of behavior is still going on, at this point, we need to come up with different responses so that we can actually protect trans and gender nonconforming people from the epidemic of violence that they're experiencing in the absence of police protection and in the form of police violence as primary kind of perpetrators of violence against trans communities. And we have to come up with other ways to respond to homelessness, to people in mental health crisis, to all the situations in which LGBT people come into contact with the police. And I definitely want to lift up what Mateo was saying around decriminalization of prostitution. There's also a campaign in D.C. as something that is not only necessary to stop criminalization of LGBT people, but also to save lives. And folks may have heard of Lailene Polanco, a trans woman who died in Rikers in police custody last week. And her original charge was for both prostitution and possession of drug paraphernalia. So we need to decriminalize, stop the war on drugs. We need to decriminalize prostitution to save lives like Lailene's.
Andrea Ritchie is co-author of Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. And Matteo Della Torre is a racial and economic justice policy advocate for the National Center for Transgender Equality. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Juliana Antoninus. I'm calling from Brooklyn. I am a trans woman, and I've had very, very bad experiences with the NYPD. Pretty much every time I interact with them, they misgender me. This includes the time that I called 911 to report a gunshot on the street outside my window. They called me and repeatedly misgendered me when I was reporting that.
I don't have any problems with the police because I don't present as anything particularly LGBTQ. They can't look at me and tell that I'm bi and polyamorous, so I don't have any problems with them.
LGBTQ listeners, we want to hear about your experiences with police. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Arun Venugopal, filling in for Tanzina. This is The Takeaway. Hundreds of thousands of people continue to protest in Hong Kong this week as police officers fire tear gas and rubber bullets into the crowds. The protesters have risen up against an extradition measure that they say would blur the line between Hong Kong's court system and mainland China's. On Tuesday, BBC journalist Grace Choi, a native of Hong Kong, told The Takeaway that the protesters are not confident they'll succeed.
With this protest, I think a lot of them might not feel hopeful. They just think this is something that we need to do to defend the city.
The business community in Hong Kong is also wary of the possible change in extradition laws, which would threaten the semi-autonomous territory status as a middle ground between China and the international business world. Here to discuss the economics of Hong Kong's extradition protests is Jiayang Fan, staff writer at The New Yorker covering Sino-US politics. Hi, Jiayang.
Hi, very happy to be here.
Now, by some estimates, 1 in 7 residents of Hong Kong are protesting. What do you make of that?
I think this is unforeseen as of 3 months ago, but it is a later chapter to the umbrella movement from a few years before. Clearly, the citizens of Hong Kong have been unhappy with Beijing's heavy hand in their rule. And it is very wary of how the communist regime has increasingly encroached on the autonomy of the region.
Have the protests, not the extradition proposal itself, but the protests, have they caused a serious disruption to the financial markets or the local economy?
I think it's causing a lot of executives, a lot of companies to be very nervous. I think there has been a dip in the market, but everyone is waiting very nervously for what's going to come next. Clearly, this is a terrifying moment for Hong Kong, but Hong Kong, unfortunately, feels very, very sandwiched between two of the world's largest economies. So, in a way, it has everything to lose, but it has very little control over its fate.
So you said it's terrifying. What is so terrifying? Let's talk about this proposal and why it scares Hong Kongers.
Right. So this proposal would allow essentially anyone in Hong Kong who's accused of a crime, I mean, there are limits on the kind of crime it is, mm-hmm. to be shipped back to China to be tried. And so much of what's attractive about Hong Kong has been its judiciary independence and the fact that it is ruled by and large by law. There is, you know, a very firm sense of the rule of law. And if this bill were to be implemented, Hong Kong would in many ways become like just any other Chinese city. And that makes it a much less advantageous place for companies to park their headquarters. And in that way, there's a sense that so much of the safety that made Hong Kong attractive to both its citizens and international corporations is being stripped away because of this bill.
Now, you mentioned some of the crimes that fall under this proposed extradition agreement. Carrie Lam, who happens to be Hong Kong's chief executive, she's already rolled back some of the crimes that would fall under the agreement, right? Can you tell us some of those changes?
Yes. So due to the level of protests and objections to the bill, Carrie Lam agreed, I think, to remove 7 of the crimes. Most of them are white-collar crimes. So this is an attempt, I think, on Lam's part to appease the business community. But the business community realizes that China has traditionally been very good at trumping up charges. So even if white-collar crimes are removed, it wouldn't be difficult for the Chinese courts to accuse someone of a wholly unrelated crime, and that would get them shipped off to China, you know, very swiftly. So that's what makes Hong Kong very nervous.
I mean, is it possible, given all that tension, that we could see companies relocate or willing to pull out if they risk losing all their mainland business?
I think that is a calculation many of them are making. I think I can see global corporations relocating to, say, Singapore, just to save themselves the uncertainty of being in a place that feels so compromised and that has, in the short term at least, no hope of gaining greater freedoms. That certainly does not seem like a possibility. If nothing else, many of these companies are devising a plan B for themselves. If they're not pulling out at this point, they're at least strategizing for an exit strategy if we come to that.
Jiayang Fan is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Jiayang, thanks so much for joining us.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Takeaways Politics Show, host Amy Walter talks with none other than Senator and 2020 presidential candidate
Bernie Sanders, state of Vermont.
It's part of a whole hour on the Democratic Socialist movement in the country.
I keep coming back to this term about socialism, but this is where it seems the Trump campaign is hoping that they can use that term for an older generation that for them, the term has very negative connotations.
Well, I think you're right. I think that is what his plan is. But I should also tell you that the word democratic, concept of democratic socialism, is increasingly positive among younger people in this country who, for a variety of reasons, are the most progressive and idealistic generation probably in the history of this country, to tell you the truth. And also economically are not doing particularly well. Everything being equal, they will probably have a lower standard of living than their parents. So for them, the concept of democratic socialism, which is not connected to Soviet Union authoritarianism, dictatorships and so forth, is somewhat different. But your point is well taken with regard to seniors. And we have got to reach out to seniors and to explain to them what we mean.
Catch the whole interview tomorrow on Politics with Amy Walter. If you don't get it on your station, make sure you check out the podcast version. You can find that on Spotify, iTunes, anywhere, or just find it at thetakeaway.org. The Toronto Raptors are trying to make history tonight by winning their first NBA championships in a Game 6 against the mighty Golden State Warriors. But the Warriors will be a little less mighty without their superstar, Kevin Durant, who ruptured his Achilles tendon in his first game back after being out for a month with a calf injury. Durant himself has said he wanted to be back out on the court that night, but the injury has raised questions about whether Durant was ready to return and whether he was pressured to come back too soon. Joining me to discuss all this is Dave Zirin. He's a sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, so walk me through how Kevin Durant or other players even get approved to play. Who is responsible for putting them on the court after an injury?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of time it depends on the stature of the player themselves and the sport itself. But in this particular case, you're talking about Kevin Durant, who's an established 30-year-old superstar. And so what you're going to have is the team and their medical staff issue their judgment in conjunction with the coaches and the team president. But factored into it will also be Kevin Durant and his push or desire or agency to want to play.
So on balance, is it possible to say like which way that tension tends to go, whether it's towards putting them on the court or holding back out of caution?
Well, I think that if we're talking about blame, which is really what we're talking about here, I think it has to start with the team itself and the medical staff of the team, because the player is always going to want to play. I mean, you're talking about a group of some of the most competitive people on earth. And then in Kevin Durant, you have that top 1% of this group of the most competitive people on earth. They're going to want to take the court. So oftentimes the goal of any medical doctor in this sort of situation is to protect a player against themselves. Now, oftentimes, though, a team doctor, and this comes from talking to many players about this, they have dual loyalties. They're not exactly operating by the terms of the Hippocratic Oath, because their job is to get a player on the court. Their job is not the health and well-being of the player themselves.
Now, you've been talking about blame. Here is Golden State Warriors president of basketball operations, Bob Myers, after the game Monday, talking about blame himself.
He was cleared to play tonight. That was a collaborative decision. I don't believe there's anybody to blame, but I understand this world. And if you have to, you can blame me. I run our basketball operations department.
So, Dave, do top brass like Bob Myers need to accept responsibility for injuries like this?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not thrilled with the way he said it, with if you have to blame somebody, blame me. You know, this idea of, well, it's really on you who's looking to blame someone, because that to me felt like a passing of the buck as opposed to actually taking responsibility. But at the end of the day, it's the team that sent him out there, and it's the team that has to take responsibility for what took place.
Now, do players in the NBA ever seek second opinions from doctors outside the team's payrolls, or are they
generally...
Yeah, tell me more
about
that.
Absolutely, they do. But it's fraught with a great deal of tension, because then you're saying that you don't trust the team themselves or their doctors. And in one of the most high-profile examples of this, you don't have to look further than the NBA Finals themselves, because the whole reason that Kawhi Leonard, the best player in this series, is starring for the Toronto Raptors and not for the team that he was with beforehand, the San Antonio Spurs, was precisely because he sought an outside analysis for the leg problems that he was having. And the team was very upset with that. And it created this tension where they wanted Kawhi Leonard on the court, and he basically sat out an entire season because his own personal doctor said that that was in his best interests. And then he found himself out of San Antonio.
And that's probably not a choice that people who are not the biggest stars in the league can necessarily take if they're desperate to remain employed, I guess.
Arun, you're hitting the nail absolutely on the head, because it's entirely a question of stature, of profile, and whether or not other teams will say, you know what, I don't care if this person marches to the beat of their own drummer. They're that good to take the risk on. Obviously, not every player can say that.
Dave Zirin is a sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, we made it through this injury-free. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Arun. Be well.
$7 million kids in the United States had a parent in jail or prison in 2010. That's the latest data that we have from the Pew Research Center. Two-thirds of these parents were incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. Those numbers might even be a low estimation due to underreporting. Antoine Patton was one of these parents. Patton served an 8-year sentence for having an illegal firearm, but while he was behind bars, he enrolled in a college program and he learned to code. Antoine taught his daughter, JJ, what he learned, and after his release in 2014, they launched an app. They called it PhotoPatch, which is designed to help kids send drawings or photos or even letters to their parents while they're incarcerated free of charge. And I have Antoine and JJ right here in the studio with me now. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us here. This is amazing.
So, Antoine, tell us, how old was JJ when you were first incarcerated?
Oh, 3 years old. 3 years old. I was 20 years old. Really active in her life, so it was really hard having to leave her.
And you were separated by some distance as well?
Yes, a lot of distance. The first state prison I went to was Elmira Correctional Facility, which was over 100 miles away from Buffalo, New York, where we're originally from.
And JJ, you were three. I mean, do you have any recollection how it felt for you when your dad was in prison?
Yeah, I was very little, so at some moments I didn't really understand. But when I finally came to realize what was happening and where he was, I just really tried to stay as positive as possible. But like, I was never down about it. I never felt bad about it. I never, like, if someone asked me where my dad was, I was always, like, not really sad to say where he was. I always was positive about things, like when I would talk to him or write him letters, because being negative doesn't help in any way. So why not make the best out of everything in life, because that can help.
Absolutely. So you were writing letters to him, huh?
Yes. I was little and I was writing letters. Sometimes I would have hard time spelling words, but I would try my best. And I was always just really happy to write letters. Sometimes I would just try to make it as like loving as possible. Like, I remember one time I wrote a letter and I put on my mom's lipstick and kissed the paper so he would be able to see my kisses to him.
Oh, my God. And so I'm guessing, Antoine, I mean, you must have all these letters. They must have meant a lot to you.
Yes, yes. I still have them to this day. Mm-hmm. I won't get rid of them for anything. Anytime we up and move, I remember we had that hurricane come hit us in Florida. I was like, I'm taking these letters with me. They mean a lot to me. They inspired me every single time I got one, brightened up my day. I remember just like looking at the correctional officer like, hey, where's my mail? Where's my mail? I know my letter has to be in there. Mm-hmm. And when it wasn't, I felt it. Like, it hit me in my heart. Like, man, I didn't get it yet. So people like, we depend on snail mail, but the process of getting stamps, getting envelopes, printing out pictures, getting it to the post office is a lot. It's kind of like a big deterrent, and it's kind of fixed into the system. It's kind of like communication isn't acknowledged. It isn't made easy. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody, they're not making it easy for us. It's kind of like they don't want us to communicate because we have to go through so many loops. In some prisons, you have to get added to the mailing list. So before you can write somebody, you have to first get approved to write someone. So imagine a 7-year-old having to get approved to write to their father or their mother in prison. Those deterrents really stop people from communicating, and that has a lot of effects, if you could think about in long run, about the bond that these parents and children have.
So the whole time that you're just trying to stay in touch, you're figuring out life on the inside, you're also starting to take classes, huh?
Yes, that was a blessing. Literally, I got enrolled into this college program really randomly while in my correctional facility. And this college would come in, private college, like the prison had nothing to do with it as far as funding. They would raise funds on the outside and then bring in these really esteemed professors from Cornell and Yale and Harvard and come and teach us these liberal art courses.
How did you get JJ involved in what you're doing in terms of, I mean, classes like coding? You're starting to get to be a good coder, and you start sharing that with her too, huh?
Right, yeah. JJ inspired me to code. She may not know that, but what happened was I started reading these articles in the USA Today about technology. This was in 2010, and the tech boom was happening as far as apps. Mobile apps were becoming this big thing. The iPhone had just came out a couple years before, and I'm sitting in prison. I'm like, what am I missing? Like, this seems like a great, great route opposed to what I used to do in the streets. So I'm like, sell an app for $1 and become a billionaire, right? That's what the dream they were selling.
Yeah. Everybody.
Yes. So I'm like, this is a way more legitimate route, and this is what I want to do. But one thing you had to do was be a problem solver. The best apps are the ones that solve a really common problem or a problem that a lot of people need. And for me, I looked at my own life, and I was like, JJ's writing these letters, but it's hard for her to get them out. How can we make it easier for them to send these letters? I started thinking, like, what if there was a cool application where kids can just, like, upload a photo, type a letter, press send, and it just goes. They don't have to worry about it again. Our team will print it out, package it, and ship it to the prison. We do all of the grunt work behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the vision. That was the problem I wanted to solve. And I come to find out you need to learn how to code to do that. So I literally went and found me a book while in prison about JavaScript, mm-hmm. HTML, mm-hmm. and I started teaching myself how to code. And that was my driving factor, was bridging this gap. And I was like, this may not be able to help JJ and I, but I know there's millions of families going through the same communication gap, the same connection problem. And we wanted to solve that problem. I wanted to solve the problem. And when I came home, kind of built this team of like my cousin, a friend of mine who I met in prison, and JJ.
It sounds like she was really positive during your incarceration, but also now you have this sort of team, this unit going. Where do things stand with this app, PhotoPatch?
PhotoPatch, JJ, you could talk more about like how many families we've been able to connect.
Yeah, definitely. It's been over 20,000 families.
Wow.
From like the last year of me building the app. Like, we've already helped a lot of families with the website. Like, that was even crazy. But like, once we got the app going, it was like, it reached so many more people so much quicker. And this next thing you know, we just have all these signups coming in. And it's like people are just ready to use our app. And it was like really, really nice to be able to have that. Like, people actually really want to use this. Like, we're actually helping people. And 20,000 is a lot, but there's still millions of other kids who have a parent in prison. So it's like we're trying to get to that level to like get it to them at least. Like, maybe they won't use it. Maybe they will be scared to use it. But at least if they know that they have the tool there, if they do finally like, okay, I'm ready, I want to use this for send to my mom or dad, then now they have us as a support system to be able to do that free and easily.
So, Antoine, we're coming up on Father's Day. And as I mentioned at the top, a lot of kids across the country are separated from their parents. Wondering if you have a message for any parents who are currently incarcerated. How do you get through that?
Keep your hopes up. Keep your head up. Like JJ said, stay positive. It really is, like, that is the fundamental thing that you can do, is just believe that your family does still love you. They do still care for you. It's a crazy world we're living in, so day to day it's hard to stay in touch, but people do care. And if you don't have the family, just know that there are people, advocates out here, so many organizations who are on a day to day fighting for you, fighting for free phone calls, fighting for cheaper communication, fighting for closing these for-profit prisons and bringing you closer to home and having these alternatives to prisons. There are people out here fighting, like, every single, we go to conferences and we go to meetups. Like, it's amazing how many people are really, really trying to affect prison reform. So I just want people to know that. And we're out here as well. Like, we're going to keep on using our experience, using our voice to make change.
And JJ, what is your Father's Day message to your dad, who's now sitting 6 feet away from you?
I love you.
Thank
That's
you,
baby. All I can really say is so much to say, but he's amazing. So children should know either way, they have a parent there to support them no matter what. If they're far away from them, their parent is still thinking about them at this moment. It's hard to know, but that's what PhotoPatch is trying to help with. Help these children know that their parents are thinking about them and want to be with them every second of the day.
Antoine Patton is the executive director of PhotoPatch, and his daughter JJ is the junior director. Thank you to both of you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Exactly. We appreciate you.
And you can find a link to Antoine's app at thetakeaway.org. And that's our show for today. I'm Arun Vanigopal, filling in for Tanzina Vega. Tanzina will be back in the host chair on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.